Okay. Well, anybody remember where we left off Sunday morning? No, I'm just kidding. We did end Sunday morning with an excellent discussion of where the transition is in Matthew chapters 24 and 25. You'll notice at the beginning, when we go back to what was the thing that started the questions, what actually precipitated the questions on behalf of the disciples for the context of where we're studying. That's the question. When are these things going to happen? But what was it that caused the questions? That's right. Those comments about the temples and the stones and how beautiful they were, how majestic they were, and the destruction. No two of these stones will be left upon each other. Total and complete destruction. So, then the questions was asked. And I find it very interesting that in Mark and in Luke, we have the same two questions. In my feeble attempt at a little bit of art here, but two basic questions in both of these is, when shall these things be? In all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you have the questions, when shall these things be? And the second question, what will be the signs when these things shall be fulfilled? Basically, the exact same thing in Luke. Now, Matthew adds a third question, and what is the third point that's added in Matthew? To that of the end of the age, or the end of the world. I looked, and every translation I could find translated that either end of age, end of world, some would say end of the Jewish economy, but I don't give a lot of a credence to that. Every one of these is, when is it going to end? When is this end of time? So we get this new question in here about when is the end of the time. Now, another point is, do the disciples really understand what they're asking? In so many ways. They don't, I mean, they're asking this. Jesus understands both this question and the destruction of Jerusalem and the larger context, but is somewhat complicated by the fact that they don't. So, somewhere in chapters 24 and 25, whether it's the end of 24, beginning 25, or whether it's in that section around 35 to where the transition happens, there is a transition to that last question which says those things about the end of time. The good thing for me tonight when we're studying chapter 25 is crystal clear, so I don't have to worry that much. Chapter 25 is very crystal clear about where the transition is, and we're talking about judgment and the end of time. But one thing I do want to point out, these are passages we know, but if we're talking about the end of time and we're discussing it, one of the things we have to do is stay in harmony. The Holy Spirit's not going to reveal one thing. Christ isn't going to say one thing here, and the Holy Spirit reveals something different somewhere else. So passage we all know, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. The heavens will pass away with a great noise. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works will be burned up. Skipping a little bit of verse 11, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 52, in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, the dead will rise incorruptible, and we shall be changed, speaking of the ones that was left. And we could look in 1 Thessalonians as well, chapter 4 and chapter 5. But all of these point to the same thing over and over. He's going to descend. It will be as with a shout, with trump, in a twinkling of an eye, in an instant, all things will change, and judgment, the end, will come, and this destruction to the earth as we know it, it will be gone. And I find it very interesting with all of these passages, if you was to turn and look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12, if you go into 13 and 14, the context of that next section is, be ye steadfast. Be ye ready. Be ye prepared. You go to 1 Thessalonians. Once again, be prepared. Why? These things are coming, and they're coming about, so therefore, be prepared. Be steadfast, or stay faithful. Be prepared. Be ready for this judgment that is to come. And interesting enough, what do you think, what is the context? What was it shifting to at the end of chapter 24 that James was talking about Sunday morning? Going to come as a thief in the night, two will be there. You know, that transition definitely is being made to be prepared. Be prepared for the, and that would definitely easily apply to both. Both there with the destruction of Jerusalem, be prepared. They were to leave, they were to flee because they could escape. But also in the end of time, they could also, the more important, be prepared. So, with that being said, with that background, it brings us to these parables of Matthew chapter 25. And that, over and over and over again, that is the thing we need to emphasize and things emphasized here, is being prepared for that judgment that is to come. And now we're looking for that judgment, you know, not the one that's already happened in AD 70. Now, you know, for our mindset, for those things that will do us good, we need to be thinking and we need to be focusing on that judgment that is to come. Now, one thing that's very different with the context of this story that is kind of strange to us, and that is the customary parade, or this, as I understand, when the bride and the groom would go to get married, there would be a parade, a procession, that would pick up with the bride and groom, and they would go to the groom's home, and they would follow along. So, that is, you know, even to the sin of why are these 10 virgins sitting around with lamps waiting to follow the bridegroom? Why are they sitting around waiting for the bridegroom? As I understand her, and definitely not from my knowledge, but from my reading, that it is from this customary parade that would have happened as a wedding was to take place. Now, what happened? Well, you've got the story is a pretty simple story, and it's fairly easy to tell the kids. The kingdom of heaven shall be likened. Each one of these begin with the kingdom of heaven shall be like. Also under the key passage of, you know, taking our transition into this kingdom that's to come. Once again, something I'm not sure the disciples completely understood. But transitioning into the kingdom of heaven shall be like. The kingdom of heaven is going to be like these 10 virgins who they took their lamps and they went out to meet the bridegroom. And there was 5 that actually took their lamps and took an extra set of oil along with them. And then there were 5 that just took their lamps and took the oil that was in their lamps. And the ones that took the extra set were actually, in the story, is called the wise virgins who took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But the bridegroom is delayed in coming. So while he's delayed in coming, they all kind of go to sleep, as is pictured here. And they kind of nap, or they kind of rest while they wait for this bridegroom to come. And about midnight, someone comes out and says, "Get ready, for the bridegroom is coming." And what do they all get up to start doing? Well, they all get up and they begin to start lighting their lamps and they get ready. Well, now the problem arises and begins to show itself. The foolish ones have a problem. What is it? There's not enough oil. So first, who do they turn to? Those that were prepared. What was the answer from the ones who were prepared? That's right. We've brought enough for ourselves. We've come and we've prepared. You can't have ours. We only brought enough for ourselves. Go where? Go and buy some. Go find someone who sells oil and buy some. So as they went away to buy, more oil, the bridegroom comes. They follow. They go into the house where the wedding party would have happened, and they close the door. Well, then after some period of time, here comes these 5 virgins that had to go back to buy oil. And start knocking on the door, open to me, and what was the response they got? "I don't know you." Yeah, that's right. "Go away." They're begging, "Lord, open to us," and he says, "I do not know you." Watch, and what is the key? Verse 13 is the key to this passage. That's right. Watch therefore. Going back to the verbiage we're using here, be prepared. Watch therefore, for you do neither know the day nor the hour in which these things will come. What was the key difference between the wise and the foolish? Preparation. One had come with enough oil that if he would have come, probably even when the bridegroom was scheduled to come or supposed to come, they would have had some. Or if he would have come earlier, they had some and they would have made it. But they did not come prepared. They did not have come that if he was delayed in his coming as he was, that they would be prepared in the end. So what is the difference? The difference is the preparedness, the forethought that they had. If the bridegroom had come earlier, would the problem have been noticed? Probably not. Probably not. Now, one of the things I find somewhat interesting is, you know, as we tell this story, we think of the wise and the foolish. But this word foolish that's given here is the word we would get the word moron from. Now, does that sound like is that a slight to another person? That's a pretty strong word. If we're going to turn and call someone a moron, that's pretty strong language. And that's one of the things we need to get and understand here. It is pretty strong. This isn't a small show of silliness. This was a really, really dumb feat with which they weren't prepared. And another key for teaching of the children, was there any more chances after that door was shut? There was no more chances. There was no more chances after the door had been shut. Some lessons I think we can pick up from this, and I don't think I'm stretching it too far here in the application of this, and that is equating versions of this story to Christians. Are they all invited? Are all invited? Yes. Did the five foolish, did they come? Yes, they come. But did they stay to the end? That's the key. Did they prepare in such a way that they were still there at the end when this hour had come? Ten came. Even the foolish included in that. Ten virgins came. But these foolish, they were not prepared. Going back to what we talked about, if you would, turn over to 2 Peter with me for just a second. Because I think this is a key point that it's not just here in Matthew 24 that the context goes from one to the other. Albert, if you don't mind, just read 3 verse 14 for me. 14, yeah. 2 Peter 3, verse 14. All right, and then turn back just a few pages to, excuse me, the Thessalonians. in the end, in verse 18, what in chapter 4, verse 18, we're told here, what was the purpose of this being told here? Yeah, words of comfort. Words of comfort. This coming to the end of time. And then in verse 4 of chapter 5, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that today should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But let those who are of day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith, love, and the helmet of hope of salvation. I can't help but to think, you know, a lot of these things that are coming through later, these come back to these exact same principles that are being taught here in this passage. You know, Paul comes back and emphasizes this. And with this, with each one of these, they're followed with, be sober, be of the day, be awake, be alert. Therefore, be prepared, be steadfast. And even if I did, somehow I managed to duplicate a slide. But anyway, five were prepared and five were not. And the sad part of this is once they realized their condition. You know, did these five that willingly started it, did they realize their condition before it was too late? No, but, you know, the preparedness was not there. One of the other things that might even be worth pointing out to some of the older of the students is who did they first reach out to? They reached out to these others that was prepared. Well, what if the ones that was prepared had have given their supplies? You know, they would have then been left out. They found out that it was too late. What other lessons would you bring out in this section? Okay. Right. Excellent point. All 10 had to come prepared and all 10 had to answer for themselves. Yes. They had prepared for what they were there to do, but they had not prepared for the obstacles. And with most things, obstacles will come. Yes, Doug. Yes. That's a good summarization of verse 13. Watch therefore. Therefore, for you know not neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Watch and be ready. Okay. Well, this next story is also one that is fairly well known to everyone. And in the story, the first thing that I almost think is obligatory to get out of the way, especially with our kids. When our kids hear the word talent, what do they think? Yeah, some ability that I have. You know, what's your talent? Well, my talent, you know, I'm going to be in a talent show. My talent is playing a piano. Mine is doing a magic trick. Mine is this. Mine is that. So one of the things I think is key to, you know, to make sure we set so that they understand the story properly is, what is talent in New Testament Scripture? It's a unit of money. It's a weight of money. And a fairly large weight of money. Yeah, of gold or silver. And I was trying to remember a dollar value that I had seen that translated into, but I think it's 33 to 36,000, depending on the time I saw that comment made. Yeah, exactly. Well, and go back just a few years, that it may not be, but you're right. But you know, tons. Okay. So that's a good way, you know, maybe not to the kids, because, you know, I wish my kid understood what a year's wages meant to them, but they don't. I'll be the first to say. Neither of mine have a good understanding of what a day's wages are, I do believe. But, you know, we need to impress upon them that this is not just money, but it is a lot of money that these people were charged with. And the other thing that I get, just as kind of an overview as I'm looking at this, I think of this as, here's a man who owns a company, or he owns some large portion of wealth, and he's going away, and before he goes away, he divvies this out to people to watch over his, you know, to watch over his company, to watch over his goods, to watch over the things, to keep it running, to keep it moving forward while he's gone. Okay, so what we have is, we have, once again, it starts with, the kingdom of heaven is like, and in this case, it's the kingdom of heaven is like this man is traveling to a faraway country. So while he's gone away, he called his servants in, and he delivered something unto them. He took to one, he gave the 5 talents, and to another he gives 2, and to one he gives 1. And in verse 15, there's a key there. How did he give it to them? Each according to what? According to their own ability. So the one who could only handle and can only do something with 1 talent, 1 weight, that was given to him. But to the one who had more ability, what more was given? And immediately he went on this long journey. And easily you can see how this is the kingdom of heaven is like. You know, here's this great responsibility, here's this great thing that's been entrusted to the servants while the master is gone. So what did the one who had 5 talents, what did he go out and do while the master was away? That's right. He worked, and he worked until that 5 had become 10. And the one that he had given 2, what did he do? He did the same. He worked until that 2 that he had been given had been turned into 4 talents. But what about the one who had just been given 1? That's right. Out of sheer fear, he pretty much goes, and he who had received 1 went and dug a hole in the ground, and he hid his Lord's money. And then the master, after some period of time, the master of those servants come and ask for a settling, a reckoning of the account. The one who had received 5, you think he come in pretty quickly? Come in pretty quickly and probably even pretty excited. Here's 5, and here's another 5 that I made for you while you was gone. Look, I have gained 5 more talents besides them. And what was the what is the quote? Well done, thy good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over what? A few things. I will make you a ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. But then he received the one who had taken 2 talents. And he said, Lord, you delivered me into 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more besides them. What was his response? That same words. Did he get some higher commendation than the one that had taken 5 and made it in 10? No. They both have been given according to their own ability. And they both got the exact same commendation when they got back. Not condemnation, but commendation when they got back. And then comes in the one who had received 1 talent. And he said, Lord, I know that you're known to be a hard man, an austere man. You reap where you've not sown. You gathered where you've not scattered. And I was afraid. I was scared. So I went out and I took the talent and I buried it. So here, look, I've brought you back what is yours. And he gave him back the 1 talent. But the Lord showed him his silliness. He showed him his foolishness when he said, look, but his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I reaped where I had not sown and gathered where I had not scattered seed. You ought to have deposited my money with the bankers. And at my coming, I would have received mine back my own with interest. Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10. For everyone who has, more will be given, and him, and he who will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast that unprofitable servant into the darkness, and there, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Or there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here's this money. Whether it was five, whether it was two, whether it was one, each was given according to his own ability, as we pointed out. Did the one who got one talent, did he have the ability to turn that into two? Just like the one who had two, had the ability to turn it into. He at least had the ability to put it in the bank and get interest. Even if he didn't know anything better to invest the money in, he could have at least put the money in the bank and gotten interest back and let someone else manage that while he was gone. So they all received some work to do while they were gone. One another comment to the word laziness that he was, you know, one of the reasons the word lazy was used, when he got back, these other two had worked while he was gone. He had hid the money. He dug a hole and put it in. The word laziness comes almost there. They'd all received something to be done. We pointed it out, but that same blessing, whether it was five becoming ten or two becoming four, that's something I think we can take away with us as well. Whether I have a lot of ability or less ability or just, you know, and once again, I'm not talking about talents and the ability to go out and do things, but responsibilities. You know, everyone here, for example, everyone here that has been given the blessing of children are charged with a responsibility to raise those children. Some have fewer responsibilities, some have more responsibilities. So I don't want to use the word talent and use it in a way that goes back to, you know, if I'm good at playing baseball, I should do that, you know, to the betterment. No, this is some responsibility, some charge that I've been given. How much will I be given? Well, different ones will be given different amounts. But we've all been given, with that charge, we've all been given something to do, some work to do. And one of the questions I found interesting as I was going through this, the one that he gave one talent to, what would have become of that one talent if it would have gone to the one that had five to begin with? Okay? Yeah. When he come back, he would have had 12, right? If this logical progression would have gone, that if he doubled, that they doubled what they had been given. So if that same one, you know, he comes back and he has 11, he would have had 12 because that same one would have doubled as well. Another thing that I find interesting there, if you come back and you relate this to responsibilities that we have, what if the responsibilities we have go left undone? And let's take that responsibility away from money, and let's take that responsibility into the teaching of our children, or whatever the other charge we may have been given, or abilities that we've been given to do. If they're left undone, you know, the consequences could be great. Why did he do nothing? Another one that I think kind of hits home. How often do we hear people who don't do things because they're scared? He was so scared. So scared of failure, so scared of losing what he had been given, that his option, his response was too scared to act at all. I think another danger that we need to be warned and aware of. Excellent point. I had not thought about that verse, but it definitely goes in. It definitely goes in here. And I think that's one of the biggest dangers, we're going to come back to it in just a second, but I think that's one of the biggest dangers that probably face many Christians today. Now, and I've already started the transition of trying to relate and bring this story to something that, you know, as it responds and as it equates to us. Have we been given, you know, is there a master who's gone away that's coming back at another time? Will there be an accounting, a reckoning? Has he left us charges, responsibilities, things to take care of while he's gone? Will there be a reckoning, an accounting? Well, that's exactly what this chapter is about. Yes, there will be this reckoning, this accounting. When he comes back, for the things that he's given us to do. So while he's gone, what will we do with these things? I think another question to impress upon our kids. Will we invest them? Will we work at what those abilities are and maybe turn those abilities, those charges, those talents, and develop it into more? Or, out of fear, will we go dig a hole somewhere and take the responsibilities? Because, you know, hey, I may do it wrong. And out of that fear that I may do it wrong, I go and hide it somewhere. And in the end, I find myself in the case that Rick just mentioned. first, you know, the first mentioned there in Revelation 2. I think you started to say something as... Well, your mouth started moving. I thought you were fixing to say something. Oh, okay. Excellent point. Two things there. One is right on task with that. Verse 26, you wicked and lazy servant. That laziness come from given something to do, given that ability and did not turn that ability into two abilities or into one responsibility into two. Another thing there is even if, you know, I am given two and maybe there are some things out there that I can't do, does that absolve me from trying? If it's something I'm supposed to do, I can still do it to the best of my ability. I'm not getting this out the way I want it to come out, but I can still do that to the best of my ability, whatever that ability is, especially if it's a charge, especially if it's a responsibility. And we also see a natural progression to those, you know, there are some that the more responsibility you give that individual, the more they're going to accomplish with that. The more, you know, you give them something to learn, and the next thing you know, they come back and they know two things because they learned something else in the process of determining to do that first task, whatever you've given them. I see it at work a lot. So just the process, and that's what something I think the next, you know, that process of always doing something, that's going to come into the next story we're going to look at. And the scary thing is, if we dig a hole and hide them, what do we have to look forward to? You know, that concept, we're going to sit on the sideline, we dig a hole and we hide the abilities, the responsibilities, the work that we've been given to do, what is the reward? Now, how does this relate back to the first story? This is in a line. The kingdom of heaven is likened to, the first one was these, they were prepared, right? At the end of that, what is the overarching, you know, at the end of it is watch therefore. You don't know the day and the hour. This is a story of judgment. This relates back in that way. It's also in this next section is also there is going to be this final day of reckoning when you got to come back and give an account for those things you've been given. Verse 13, watch for his return because you do not know. They were to watch for the bridegroom to come and to be prepared. They're both to be prepared when he returns. One, prepared to give an account for what he's done. The other was to be prepared in the way of have enough oil ready. And in both cases, there's two that weren't prepared. Okay. One of the questions that, you know, at the end of that you see asked a lot, and I'm just going to kind of pose it to you. Why was it the one talent taken and given to the one who had five and turned it into ten versus the one who had two and turned it into four? You know, in our mind of fairness today, what would you think in the mind of fairness? What would you think? Well, give a half talent to this one, a half talent to this one. But what was it, you know, what was the point? Just what's the point that was made there? It was taken and given to the one who had ten. And the, you know, the investment was higher. To the one more has been given, I might should read that instead of trying to quote it. Verse 20 what? 29, thank you. It's amazing when you're looking for something, how it moves. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he who will have abundance, but from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. So this was taken away. This one that was given to the ability to do more was given more work to do. And that's also something that happens quite frequently too. To the one who has the most ability, more work should be given to that person to do because they're going to accomplish it. They're going to accomplish it faster. Okay. Now, to this third story that's given in this concept of, in this chapter on the final time, the end of the age, to go back to our concept, this one in verse 31, it does not end with, for the kingdom of heaven is like. It does not begin with, for the kingdom of heaven is like our first two did. It starts with when the Son of Man comes in His glory. So here it is. So we don't, you know, we basically go straight to when the man comes in the Son of Glory with His holy angels with Him, He's going to sit on His glorious throne. Who's going to be gathered to Him in verse 32? Everyone, all nations, Jews and Gentiles alike, will be gathered to Him. And what's He going to do in the story? He's going to separate. Notice that here in the story, he's called the king. He's going to separate. He's going to have the sheep to the right and the goats to the left. I'm dyslexic, or I'm doing it on your side, whichever way you want to say it. But he's going to separate out the sheep to his right and the goats to his left. And then, to the sheep, he's going to say, come to those, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. What was their response? What was the righteous's response when he said, I was sick, and you brought me food? You did this for me, you did this for me, you did this for me. What was their response? When did I ever do that for you? Shock, awe. When did I ever do that for you? What was his response? When you've done it to the least of these, my brethren. Done it to me. And then he turned to those, to the goats, or to the one on the left, and he said, depart from me, you cursed, and enter into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will answer him and say, once again, I think in shock. Because these people, if they would have seen Jesus in this kind of need, do you think they would have done something for him? Yeah. But what was their question? When do we ever see you in this kind of need and not take care of your needs? And his answer was, what? That's right. If you did not do it to the least of these, my brethren, you have not done it unto me. That is a dangerous, you know, and a sobering statement. How would it would have felt? The shock, the surprise, the voice inflection, they would have said, for me? What? When did I do this for you? And when they would have heard the words of blessing, or the complete and total despair when they would have heard, depart from me. What do you mean? I don't recall ever seeing you in trouble and not help you out. This passage does not teach they were only saved by good words. And we, you know, we're not, by no means are we trying to say that these people were saved only because of these good works that they had done. We can go plenty other places and see there's more that goes to it. However, I think we make the point that their lack, you know, someone's lack of these. If they've done all the other things, but I do believe their lack of these activities, these goodwill, probably more than good works, could harm their salvation, could destroy their salvation. What are some things that we learn we should be doing while we're waiting for this end of time? Isn't that the question at hand here? While we're waiting for the end of time, what kind of business should we be about doing? That's right, feeding the hungry, clothing the ones without clothes, you know, visiting the ones in prison, all of the things in this list, and obviously that expands somewhat to what we can do, but these are the things we should find ourselves busy about doing while we wait for this end of time to come. Notice at the end of the story, the fate of the foolish, and there I did it. I keep saying versions, and there I even typed it. Sorry. They started, but they didn't prepare. What was the fate? The fate of the ones who was given responsibility according to his ability. But instead of using it, he dug and buried it. The fate of the one who didn't perform the good works, the good wills. The fate of the devil and his angels. Their fate was all the same at the end of these stories. Depart from me, you workers of iniquity, into the lake of fire that's prepared for the devil and his angels. They're still, in response to this question we ask, what will be the end of the time? Jesus' answer was pretty clear that the time itself, when it's going to happen is unknown. We don't know when it's going to come as a thief in the night. But he did give some things that they could be doing. He could give them some things to be doing. And if they're working on those things at the end of that third story, guess what? They're probably going to be prepared. If they're busy about doing the things that he says they should be doing while they're waiting for the end of time, they should be prepared. That's what was important at the end of this. In these next few verses, there's a few sections here where first Jesus predicts his death. He says, it's come the time that when he had finished all these sayings, he had sat down with his disciples, and he says, you know, we're 2 days away from the Passover. And after these 2 days, at the end of the Passover, the Son of Man is going to be delivered up. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be crucified. He's telling them more and more plainly. They're still not completely getting it, but he is more and more upfront and honest with them. The chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people, what are they wanting to do? Want to kill him. They've got one thing. They don't want to do it at the feast because they don't want to upset who? The people. They're scared of the people. And they don't want to upset the people. So they're saying, not here at the feast, but they want to take him by trickery and kill him in any way they can. So we come to the end of that where they've been challenged at everyone. And there is one who stands up, Judas by name. And he goes to him. We already know that he's a lover of the money. He wanted the money that was put into the purse because he was a thief. He would take it back out. And he went to the chief and the priest, and what question did he ask? What will you give me? What's he worth to you? What are you willing to give me if I deliver him up to you? What did they promise to give him? 30 pieces of silver. So sad that the Savior was betrayed for 30 pieces. But from that point on, Judas sought out a time which he could betray Jesus. So these things are all working. Jesus has finished these speeches. All of these things, all these forces are working in the background. Waiting for the Lord's Supper, waiting for the events to happen right afterwards. And it comes time that he says, prepare the Lord's Supper. And I'm going to leave that with James. That's one of those stories I almost got through. But that's one of those stories that I don't necessarily want to completely rush through. So thank you for your time and your attention. If the battery's alive.